parsons practice what they preach. Then Boney Hill come bouncing down and march his men on London town. Rollicum roarum, tollalorum, rollicum roarum, tollalay, rollicum roarum, tollalorum, rollicum roarum, tollalay. Justice is hold equal scales, and rogues are only found in jails. Then Boney Hill come bouncing down and march his men on London town. Rollicum roarum, tollalorum, rollicum roarum, tollalay, rollicum roarum, tollalorum, rollicum roarum, tollalay. Men find their wealth a curse and fill therewith the poor man's purse. Then Boney Hill come bouncing down and march his men on London town. Rollicum roarum, tollalorum, rollicum roarum, tollalay, rollicum roarum, tollalorum, rollicum roarum, tollalay. When husbands with their wives agree and mates would wed from modesty, then Boney Hill come bouncing down and march his men on London town. Rollicum roarum, tollalorum, rollicum roarum, tollalay, rollicum roarum, tollalorum, rollicum roarum, tollalay.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com. on the net. Following my review of the Apricot Cafe on Denmark Place and the surrounding carnage a couple of weeks ago, I received a heartwarming email from Mr. David Murphy. With his permission, I can share some of his comments. Very enjoyable piece on this area, which appears to be in a state of total destruction. The constant terraforming of the urban landscape has its proponents who seem to have surrendered to the idea that the built environment is no more than a bland shelving system, expanded from the shelves in a supermarket with a couple of cheap box girders and glass monstrosities to render scale and purported interest, such as the Shard at London Bridge or Primark at Oxford Street. The plans for so-called Canada Water are a window on what is the nightmare of overcrowding and cheap urban design, where every civic amenity is crammed into a mean and pinched corner, while open public space becomes a thing of the past. My unhappy lot is to witness this destruction from the top of a London bus on my travels, in this case the 24 or the 29 from Charing Cross Road, or for a real eyeful at ground level, the 73 heading towards the ultra-civilised environs of Clissold Park, and the listed 1930s Stoke Newington Town Hall, where I noticed today hung on the railings a smallish pink card disc saying, George Melly and Eartha Kitt played here. But surely not on the same bill. What a night that would have been. As we sail up to Tottenham Court Corner, just before centre point on the right, I cast a fond look to the left at a hole in the ground, where there was once a row of highly interesting and typical London buildings, a semi-defunct theatre, a once-thriving gay disco, and remember also the arty cinema just around the corner along Oxford Street, where I had my first encounter with classic French films and have enthused ever since. That sounds almost certainly like the Academy, David. There was also the 100 Club and another gay venue, as I remember. The area was also well provided with vinyl record shops when this was a serious medium and not the fashion token it has become today in some quarters, as you also refer to in your piece on the Barbican. The celebrated gramophone exchange in the corner of Soho Square, staffed by sales assistants in white coats like doctors. Tin Pan Alley is also under threat. Most of this land, I understand, belongs to the Church of England, which is a voracious commercial landlord, forcing interesting businesses out for high street brands at one end of Charing Cross Road, while appearing to succour to the homeless and hungry in Trafalgar Square at the other end at St Martin's. With my limited view and knowledge, and armed only with a handful of personal memories and bits picked up, for example, in Max Jaffa's autobiography, A Life on the Fiddle, which describes his childhood in the area, both sides of Oxford Street, were Jewish tenements and at constant war with each other around the turn of the 20th century. I think it's fair to say that unlike in previous phases, even during the war, when redevelopment and building and change was evolutionary and undertaken at a thoughtful human pace, the fast and furious rampage to squeeze as much money out of each square centimetre of topsoil and provide the infrastructure to make this possible at whatever cost is a step change, a sign of fairly desperate economic thinking, unprecedented and ultimately unsustainable. For surely they will destroy what makes London attractive in the first place and kill the goose that lays the golden egg. I depart to live in Marseille shortly, in modest bedsit cheap accommodation. I aim to reconnect after a lifelong period of buckling down, making do, earning a menial wage, kissing arse, and generally suppressing every artistic nerve in my body, with a happy childhood of sketching in the Oedipal glow of my mother's approbation. For it was she who begged the butcher for extra sheets of white paper so her boy could draw. I will sit in the old port doing my thing. I aim to create a few carte postale or souvenirs, some of which could be three-dimensional, of Marseille in transition. Not the sugar-coated candies of the tourist trade, the impressionists, or even earlier studio artists such as Jean-Baptiste Olive. Marseille is facing change too. I wish to make thoughtful impressions and always at the centre, the inhabitants, the marvellous people of Marseille, like characters stepping out of one of Daumier's prints, for he was born there too, and you don't have to walk very far along any street to encounter them. I hope to bring them back and exhibit them early next year. Looking forward to this adventure and would very much wish to chat with you then. By all means, use my spin-off from your own piece, with or without my name. So those were comments by listener David Murphy. Thanks for that, David. And when you return from Marseille, you're welcome to come on the show and vent your spleen or anything else you want to vent. Let's get this moving. Last week, I was in Weymouth again with the distinguished sound artist Sandra Cross. We've been going to Weymouth two or three times a year for about 20 years now. I find the area endlessly interesting. The so-called Isle of Portland, the prison, Chesil Beach, old Weymouth Harbour, the varied landscape, the failed gentrification in spite of the recent Water Olympics, traces of a naval presence. Books afloat on a back street where the tourists never venture and which is full of maritime memorabilia, model submarines and crockery from obsolete shipping companies. Moonfleet, where we once rented a cottage over Christmas, arriving just in time to watch Fritz Lang's film of Moonfleet, which was on TV by coincidence. Sea Barn Farm, campsite from where you can see all the way from Lyme Regis to Portland Bill. The defunct helipad with an ex-military conning tower, which has been rented by a mysterious writer for the last 20 years. The Royal Hotel on the Esplanade, which Joseph Losey featured in his 1961 film, The Damned, the soundtrack of which you can vaguely hear in the background, and which I could bring up for the opening song, which was written by Losey, specifically for the Gang of Teddy Boys.
Before. black leather, black leather, rock, rock, rock. Black leather, black leather, ta, ta, ta. Black leather, black leather.
Oh, look at this, Dave. Hello, darling.
Hey, 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 hey.
Black leather, black leather, rock, rock, rock. Black leather, ta, ta, ta. Black leather, hip, hip, hip. I got that feeling, black leather rock. Black leather, crash, crash, crash. Black leather, kill, kill, kill. I got that feeling, black leather rock. Black leather, smash, smash, smash. Black leather, crash, crash, crash. Black leather, kill, kill, kill. I got that feeling, black leather rock.
Forward into battle, dear chaps.
All right, let's have it.
Come on in. Get your money now. Let's have it.
All right, we're going to have some marching.
Right, left, right, left, right.
Move along there. Move along. Go on, get out of it. Go on. Move along there.
Yeah, well, that's the opening of The Damned by Joseph Losey. After fresh crab sandwiches at my tea shop overlooking the harbour, we decided to visit for the first time the Tudor House Museum, two adjoining houses rescued from demolition in the 1950s by local architect Walmsley Lewis. Outside, or actually halfway through the entrance, a crudely painted wooden cutout of a Tudor woman clutching a broom. After paying the £4 entry fee, our guide started to describe her own overview of Tudor life within the cottages, which quickly developed into a litany of melancholic negativity, out of which it was impossible to escape. Infant mortality rates, 7 out of 10. Adult mortality rate, death by 35 if lucky. The vast fireplace where the housewife, dressed in many layers of unwashed material spattered with cooking fat, would almost certainly die after being engulfed in flames. The deadweight shovel, the witch's cauldron of a cooking pot. Letting the fire go out resulted in humiliation. All water being poisonous obliged people to drink beer, children drinking weaker or small beer, and being forced to stand at the board or table whilst eating. The man of the house occupying the best chair, hence chairman of the board, the table doubling as a guest bed, hence bed and board. The threshold, so named because it held back thresh, the accumulated filth and excrement for which the English were notorious. But our guide was dogmatic that the French were even filthier, and apparently still are. You're not related to French people, are you? She asked belatedly. By now, we didn't want to cramp her style, so we just smiled knowingly. Of course, only the French evacuated their bowels by standing in the dark over a squalid hole in concrete surrounded by giant disease-infested blue bottles, we concurred silently. She continued, nobody in Tudor times washed, ever. So they became accustomed, even competed with each other's stench. Carpets, if they could be afforded, would be kept on the tables for fear of becoming soiled by feet which had walked through the rising fetid thresh. Urinating into fireplaces was normal. Now upstairs in the bedroom, we learned that the bedding would never have been washed or changed, resulting in all manner of verminous infestations. The guide's own parents had still been paying a 10% tithe to the church, being Baptists, right up until 10 years ago. In Tudor times, failure to pay the tithe led to confiscation of items such as a dairy cow, resulting in death from starvation. In fact, any confiscation of worldly goods would lead to early death. People were disposable. In the other room, a wooden plate called a trencher. The master of the house would eat stew off bread, and the poorer members of a household would eat the remnants of the bread, and would, of course, then die of malnutrition. Stepping out from the darkness at noon of the Tudor house into the bright sunshine, we enter the vast red brick Brewer's Quay building, once heralded as the Covent Garden of Dorset, which, temporarily lacking any more useful purpose, has been turned into an enormous emporium for second-hand detritus, masquerading as vintage paraphernalia, most of which would be rejected from a charity shop, in the midst of which sat dislocated tourists consuming cupcakes and muffins. Beyond the esplanade, along the sea wall, past Lodmore Nature Reserve, the suburb of Weymouth known as Malcolm Regis, which is thought to be the first port at which the Black Death came into England in June 1348, possibly aboard a spice ship or an army ship. We went in search of Jordan Hill Roman Temple and followed the southwest coast path towards Osmington Mills, which took us through an amusement village and up a gradient passing close to the Riviera Hotel, built in the 1930s, which served during the war as a sanatorium for American soldiers and was refurbished recently at a cost of £4 million, with 98 ensuite rooms on two floors spreading outwards symmetrically from a single narrow Art Deco tower, all painted blue and white, overlooking a swimming pool, giving the impression of a cosmeticised municipal waterworks. Perversely, the entire complex faces towards Weymouth, the splendid view to the open sea being deprived of anyone in the hotel. The same is true of the aptly named Portland Heights Hotel, a building in one of the most magnificent locations in Britain. From the cliff top and the bar, one can see all the way along Chesil Beach to Abbotsbury, Bridport, and on a clear day to Lyme Regis. But all the rooms overlook the car park, as if planners and architects had conspired to deprive hotel guests of anything like a good view from their bedrooms. Well, perhaps this is why Joseph Losey chose Portland as the location for The Damned, a Hammer film production shot in and around Weymouth and Portland. Joseph Losey had decided to seek exile in Britain rather than return to Hollywood and face the right-wing extremists who were masquerading as protectors of the state. It was during the making of The Prowler, which was written by the then blacklisted screenwriter Dalton Trumbo under the pseudonym Hugo Butler, that Losey was summoned to testify before the House Committee on Un-American Activities, a congressional body which had been set up to root out communist subversives. Losey, with his connections to Brecht and Trumbo, fell into that category. In Britain, Losey made films under pseudonyms such as Victor Hanbury and Joseph Walton. Hammer Films offered Losey The Children of Light, a novel by H.L. Lawrence. The plot of the novel is as follows. On the run from police, after accidentally killing his unfaithful wife, Simon Largwell falls foul of a gang of teddy boys led by the sadistic Caesar. Largwell escapes with Reed's half-sister, Oliver Reed playing the part of Caesar, Joan, and the two find refuge in a secret government base on the south coast. There they encounter 14 children, all white-haired and all 10 years old. A local reporter becomes involved and all three become inflicted with a strange, debilitating sickness. After escaping with one of the children, the machinery of the state catches up with them. Largwell is brought before a high-ranking civil servant who explains that the children have been irradiated after an accident at an atomic plant. They now thrive on radiation, allowing them to survive an impending nuclear holocaust. For Joan and Largwell, it is too late. They will die from nuclear poisoning, but the authorities make sure by killing them in a prearranged road traffic accident. I suspect that Losey and perhaps H.L. Lawrence had visited the Tudor cottages in Weymouth. Losey saw in Lawrence's novel another opportunity to combine art and politics in Brechtian fashion. Losey changed the Hammer screenwriter for his longtime collaborator and fellow blacklistee Ben Barsman, and in 1961 they worked on the script. 2 weeks before shooting, Losey commissioned a rewrite from TV scriptwriter Evan Jones, switching the location from Hampshire to Dorset, specifically the genteel seaside town of Weymouth and the cliffs of Portland. Two actors were imposed by the studio, Oliver Reed, who had just starred in The Curse of the Werewolf, and Shirley Ann Field, who had shot to fame in Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. Losey wanted to call the film The Brink, but Hammer opted for The Damned after Wolf Riller's Village of the Damned, which also featured strange white-haired children. While the basic plot is absurd, the prevalent mood of the time, with the threat of nuclear war, seemed only too real. The inclusion of a sculptor working on the cliffs with real sculptures by Elizabeth Frink, which resemble the dead post-Hiroshima, contributes to the general aura of doom. After numerous disagreements between all concerned, explained at length in Hammer, British Cult Cinema by Bruce G. Hallenbeck, The Damned was shelved for 2 years before finally being released in 1963 in a shortened version cut from 94 minutes to 87. In America, the film was cut again to 77 minutes and not released until 1965 as These Are the Damned. Oliver Reed's character was almost certainly an influence on the Malcolm McDowell character in Kubrick's Clockwork Orange, right down to the umbrella that both use as a weapon. Losey was obsessive about the score for the film, and he and Jones wrote the lyrics to Black Leather Rock. Troy Howarth, writing in Eccentric Cinema, said of The Damned, "It remains one of the director's most powerful anti-authority diatribes. The film is damning in its commentary, but is distinguished by a vein of humanism. Even the character Bernard is to be pitied to some degree, making the film less about good guys versus bad guys than it is about a society that is doomed, precisely because people's principles will lead them astray. It is arguably the finest film Hammer ever made and ranks alongside Accident as Losey's most engaging film." A final quote from Hallenbeck: "Its bleak vision may anchor it in the uncertainties of the Cold War, but it also speaks to the post-9/11 world. We are now those children, and we are still prisoners to war, violence, and the mendacity and insanity of our political masters." Throughout the film, the architecture and landscape of Weymouth and Portland are clearly recognisable. And today's programme includes snatches of The Damned with some field recordings I've made in that area over the years and songs by the English composer Gerald Finzi, who set his music to poems by Thomas Hardy, who lived in Dorchester.
"You didn't invite me anywhere. You invited a little tart that you picked up on the street."
"Well, who are you, Lady Godiva?"
"That would make you Peeping Tom."
"Oh."
"Whoever I am, I'm not who you think. You never even asked my name."
"With a figure like that, you don't need a name." "Okay. Okay, it's all my fault. I thought you were a little tight. I'll do better than that. I still think so." "Now, what's your name?"
"Joan."
"My name is Simon."
"How'd you do, Simon?"
"How'd you do, Joan?"
"Little thing.
Why are you here?"
"I'm on holiday."
"From what?"
"Everything. I used to be an insurance executive, but I decided to give it up."
"It's a nice life."
"What is?"
"To be able to give it up. If you don't like what you're doing, I mean."
"Your friends are never very far away."
"Oh, allow me to correct you, dear chap. Joni here is my sister."
You couldn't be.
Oh, yes. And I'm sure your sort isn't interested in my sister.
Is that why you send her out into the streets?
Simon!
Get out of the boat, Joni.
Stay where you are, Joni.
If I was Simon, I'd let her go.
Now, if you want to go fishing, Simple Simon, you may go.
Don't ever do that again, Joni.
I'll do what I like, King.
Do you think I'll let a man put his dirty hands on you? Dead man.
What's he got to do with the oil? What you got to do with it?
About the rabbit.
We found it one day in here, and we used to play with it.
But it grew sleepy and its hair fell out. And the Black Death came and took it away.
We can't tell you everything now. We've got to get you out of here. Will you show me the doors?
There's the cave door, and there's the lift which the Black Death comes down.
And?
But there's another door.
Will you take me there?
No, he can't. The eyes will see him. That doesn't matter. I've worked out all the blind spots.
Come on, William. We may not have much time.
What is it, Simon?
Don't worry. Just wait for me.
Good morning.
I thought you'd better see this place soon, sir. Here, I'm fine. I wish you had let me investigate that hideout, sir.
Sir.
On seven.
What's he doing?
He's following one of the children.
It'll be young William. Very ingenious of young William. But he forgot that Wells is 6 feet tall. Turn them off. I hate those things.
But they are necessary.
It is not necessary of you to tell me so.
Well, the others may be dead, or they may be with him.
If he went over the cliff when the tide was right, he could have reached the cave.
Well, then there must be something wrong with the cave door.
Unless he didn't go over the cliff at all.
Check the birdhouse door first. Make sure that Miss Nielsen doesn't see you. Then take a boat out and check the cave entrance. When we find out how he got in, we can worry about getting him out. He's been there too long already. I do not want the children to watch him die.
The hair of my flesh stood up. And the spirit said, I can make the clock of the years go backward. But I'm loath to stop it where you will. And I cried, agreed to that, proceed. It's better than dead. He answered peace and called her up. As last before me, then younger, younger she grew to the year I first had known her woman grown, and I cried, cease, thus far is good, it is enough, let her stay thus always. Thank you.
Very sorry to tell you this, but here is dangerous for them. They will become ill. They will go sleepy if they stay with you. They are warm, and nothing that's warm can live with you. You will remember what happened to the rabbit.
You're just trying to frighten us, sir. We don't believe you. You killed the rabbit because we loved it. You sent the Black Death for it because we loved it.
I love you, children, and I'm trying to protect you.
You don't!
You don't!
You don't!
You don't!
Think, children, think, think. You will have to do as I say.
King! King! Where are you? King! King! The Black Death is coming! They're going to take you away!
What is it, Henry?
You'll get sleepy like the rabbit.
No, we won't. We're going to get out. We're going to take you with us. Will you climb out and open the cave door for us?
What's the good of that?
I've been to the other door. It's no good without a key.
You think you can climb these cliffs?
We'll have to swim for it.
Through those rocks with a tide like that with the kids. Let them come for us.
Don't go, King.
King, we've seen too much. Are you coming or not?
Thank you.
I know it's kid stuff knocking about in a gang. But what else is there to do?
What would you like to do?
I don't know.
Something you want to do, no?
Had to send someone down because of your disobedience. I want you to keep quiet still. Stay out of the way. Children, that's not instructive. This will accomplish absolutely nothing. This is a crisis. You do not understand what is happening. Now try to be quiet. Think, think. You will have to do as I say eventually.
better come out, Holland. We can't direct you.
Simon, she's sick.
Be careful. Now, the children were opening the locks with the radiation of their own bodies. Now, I've been here, and we needn't worry about the cave door, because I've checked it.
Then take a complete detachment to this door. Alert the helicopters in case they get any farther. And Gregory, if Miss Nielsen's at the studio, make sure she doesn't see anything. And hurry.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Anybody there?
Henry's gone, in the car.
I've seen you before. You're the man who knows all about violence, aren't you? You're the man who knows all the answers, aren't you? Why are you doing this? What's it all for? What are you trying to make out of these children? What do you want with us? Answer me. Will you answer me?
Where is Major Holland?
He's down there.
Is he alive?
He's alive.
Gregory, get him out of there, quickly as possible.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Wells, you and the young lady may go to your boat.
Children, Bernard!
The worst of this incident is that my children will now think of themselves as prisoners and as freaks.
Did you do this thing to them, Bernard?
They were born as they are. Their mothers were exposed to an unknown kind and level of radiation by an accident. I don't need to tell you that there are such accidents. 300 in the past 15 years. That is a fact. We don't yet know how to repeat the exact conditions that produced these children.
You mean you would if you could?
Certainly. Freya. Freya. It is now desperately important that you should try to understand me. And what I am doing. Life has the power to change. After the first great explosion, strange, wonderful flowers, unknown before, bloomed in the desert. To survive the destruction that is inevitably coming, we need a new kind of man. An accident gave us these 9 precious children. The only human beings who have a chance to live in the conditions which must inevitably exist when the time comes. Every civilized nation is searching, searching for the key to survival that we have found.
I don't want to hear any more about it.
I didn't want you to know. You will remember my warning when you arrived.
But you let the American and the girl go.
They are dying already. They will never make contact with another human being. And when they die, the boat will be destroyed. Freya, you too know my secrets. Now, my children are the buried seeds of life. When that time comes, the thing itself will open up the door, and my children will go out to inherit the earth.
What earth, Bernard? What earth will you leave them?